Alors, on a beaucoup de chance parce que, outre le fait que Shihab Shama est un des grands spécialistes de la neurophysiologie, de l'audio et de la modélisation autour de la neurophysiologie, c'est aussi un des derniers Américains qui a eu le droit de prendre l'avion. Parce qu'il y a un ban sur la permission de venir en France pour tous les universitaires maintenant aux États-Unis. Il a reçu le message juste à l'arrivée en France, comme quoi il n'avait pas le droit de venir en France. Donc on a pas mal de chance, même beaucoup de chance, de l'avoir ici. Et ce que je voulais dire, c'est que ce qui est très intéressant aussi sur le travail que fait Shihab et un certain nombre maintenant de neurophysiologistes, c'est qu'ils sont vraiment à l'interface entre, d'un côté, le traitement du signal, c'est-à-dire la compréhension au niveau du signal des traitements qui sont faits ici par les furets, tout leur système audio, mais aussi la partie machine learning, apprentissage et le lien maintenant avec les réseaux de neurones, sauf que là, ce ne sont pas des théories ou des algorithmes, c'est vraiment regarder ce qui se passe, vous le verrez à l'intérieur des systèmes corticaux, et donc je te laisse la parole.
Thank
Merci
you.
Beaucoup de venir faire ce séminaire.
So I'll switch to English, if you don't mind. And I'm very happy to be here. As Stéphane explained, I just made it out of the official university travel. And pretty much all universities in the United States now shut down, partly because of the spring break and partly because an excuse for the virus. And I know that you're not here to really listen about the ferrets or Da Vinci or prehistoric men, but what I'll try to convey to you is why I study these animals and try to tell you, you who are people interested in artificial intelligence and neural networks and so on, how do we learn from these animals to convey to the engineering world or to the natural sciences, how do we convey to them what we learn from these animals? So obviously the most important and obvious thing is all of the behavioral things that the brain does. So there's cognition, behavior, sensory perception, motor control, and sensory motor coordination, among the other things. It's really great to learn from other animals how they do these functions so that we can build them in our systems. And of course, the approaches that you follow and that you have to study is first and foremost experimentation. You have to design experiments to learn from the animals what they hear and what is in their brain. Then you need to abstract them. Often we have to simulate, and a lot of our work also involves actually building electronic versions of these things. You'll learn very different things from each of these different approaches, and they really are not, you can't substitute one for the other. Things you learn from this level, it's just very difficult to get from here and so on. So I'll be happy to talk about all these things, but just to put it, give you a realism, point of realism, maybe a bit humbling, when you think you have a complex neural network with 150 layers of neurons and all that, remember, just about every neuron or every element in that network is a little ball and stick with some nonlinear function. As complicated as you want to make it, the billions of neurons in our brain come in all these different varieties of shapes. Each one of them comes like that. And people spend a lifetime studying one little part. And they're incredibly complex and full of nonlinear functions, if you will. And so it's I guess it's obvious that the shapes of these different neurons are trying to perform different functions, different computations. And there is a reason why they acquire this shape versus this shape versus this shape to accomplish that function. Let me just say, this has nothing to do with the complexity of the animal. In fact, many animals like insects, for example, have far more complex neurons than many of the neurons that we see in mammalian systems. So this is really nature's way of trying to solve problems, very much like what we do with electronics nowadays. Instead of building generalized components, we build specialized circuits, because that way they become more efficient at doing one task and doing it rapidly and with less power and so on. Now, to get these kinds of pictures and all that, we have to basically open up the brain and look inside, and can be as trivial as sticking a wire into the brain and putting it right next to it, one neuron, and seeing what its output looked like. But you can stick this wire into the neuron and then study what it's doing inside, what the electrical potentials look like inside. Of course, you could also image it. You could study it with incredible variety of approaches nowadays. And okay, so enough about the neural, real biological structures. The work I do tends to be a bit more systems oriented. So the way we get motivated is by a simple cartoon like this, where we ask a question like, as a really simple task, as a listener in a room like this, and I'm talking, and often there's other sound sources in the environment, and to your ear now, there are tons of energy coming, bouncing from the walls and from the floors and all of that. And you can effortlessly listen to one source and ignore other sources and ignore all the reverberation and all of that, and extract from these signals a huge amount of information. In case of sound, you extract from it the spectrum of the sound, and then from the spectrum of the sound, you can extract from it all kinds of attributes, like the pitch of the sound, if you're listening to a melody, where the sound is coming from, what the meaning of the sound is, and a variety of other things. And if you want to really look at this from a systems point of view, so you're not looking at one neuron at a time or any of that stuff. You get pictures like this. So if you just look at here, for example, this is the simplest route going from your eardrum, from the sound as it goes into your ear at the level of the cochlea, which I will spend a little time explaining to you, where the sound gets transformed into neural activity, and it goes on a cable called the auditory nerve into the first station called the cochlear nucleus, which is basically a central processor with many subdivisions. And from there, you get a lot of parallel pathways that go out to a variety of other nuclei and centers, and each connected all the way up. The shortest pathway takes about 5 connections from here up to the cortex, cortex being the place which is basically what you see when you open up the skull. Now, this is the shortest pathway, and there are, we think, a lot of functions accomplished, transformations accomplished to the sound from the acoustic waveform at the eardrum all the way to the electrical activity in the cortex. And many of the things I just mentioned, like the pitch, timbre, location, and so on, get somehow extracted out at all of these different places. Now, when you get a simple diagram like this, and you want to make a head start, you want to write some kind of transformations of what happens to the sound as it goes to the cortex. And as you'll see in a minute, the cortex itself is composed of many, many regions and divisions, and all connected one to the other, to the other, to the other. So when you want to just up to the cortex, you draw a simple engineering diagram of that, where each of these nuclei can be drawn as a square box, and then with an arrow connecting it, you immediately discover how useless this is. Because where do you begin, even? And everything is connected to everything, and this is not all the boxes. And and one thing you notice, that all the arrows are pointing upwards, pointing towards the cortex. In reality, there are 10 times as many connections going down, backwards, than going forward. So that's, if I draw that, of course, there's absolutely nothing you can begin to do. So hopefully by the time you leave today, I'll make some sense of all of these diagrams, at least at a trivial, generalized level, that is inspiring enough that you can think it's worthwhile going and studying one of these boxes for a long time. We really have very few people studying all these different regions. And this is a major sensory system that is involved in language, involved in music, what makes us human. And it's not because there are no resources and all that stuff. It really is an incredibly difficult task. And you feel like you're making so little progress when you realize that just this little box here has so many varieties of cells, so many subdivisions, and it's like somebody dumps on your desk a computer and gives you a voltmeter and say, explain to me how this machine works, by going after one component at a time. And it's literally like this. All right, so I'm gonna tell you first about two major transformations that happen in this system. One is at the cochlea, at the very beginning, where there's one Nobel Prize in audition that explained how this thing works, or at least began to explain how it works. And I'll tell you another one over here. And I'll consider this the input and this the output. And everything else here will be one nice linear system, maybe with a ReLU. So, but still is worth it. So let me begin with the first, the cochlea. This is the cochlea in mammals. It's a structure that is coiled. Nobody really has a clue why the coiling is relevant or important. Doesn't seem to have any functional purpose other than to save space. But basically, it's a cavity in a bone, and it's about 2-3 turns in humans. And if you unroll it and look at it, it sort of looks like this. So very briefly, if you look at a cross-section of the auditory part of the cochlea and that structure, which is vibrations in the air, the one-dimensional waveform, the sound, moves your eardrum, and of course it's already significantly filtered by the time it comes to your eardrum, because the pinna, the external ear, is a beautiful filter that filters the sound according to where it's coming from, and that gives you, the brain uses that to tell you where the sound is coming from, especially elevation in humans. And it's the reason why you lose the ability to hear sound in space when you put headphones, is because you render your external ear useless. You basically remove it. And so when you put the sound directly into your eardrum, you cannot perceive the sound as coming from outside. And there's a lot of interesting studies on this whole thing. But anyway, the eardrum moves. That's in air. The cochlea itself is full of fluids. Basically, most of it is seawater. And because we inherited, by the way, the whole system from the lateral line on the fish. And all of these structures that you find in frogs and fish and all that became internalized in mammals. And we use them for, again, hearing vibrations in water, which is the water here inside the cochlea. But the vibrations in the air need to be moved to vibrations in the fluid here, and there's a big impedance mismatch, and that's taken care of by the bones in the middle ear. So any vibrations in and out here move these three bones which are attached together, and that causes vibrations in and out in this bone right here. The stapes, it's called. There is a diaphragm here that protects the fluid from leaking out. There's another diaphragm here. And the cochlea itself is really, although it's one bony tube, it has all these tissues that separate it into three tubes. One is the upper one, the lower one, scala vestibuli, scala tympani, and then a middle one. The upper and middle, you see, I'm sorry, the upper and lower are connected. You see that, one fluid. So when the bone here moves in, the fluid is not compressible. It basically, the fluid gets pushed in and then pushed out. So movements like this here produce movements in the diaphragm here in the opposite phase. So all the vibrations of sound go like this here and in the opposite phase here, and that sets up basically a pressure difference between these two chambers. That pressure difference is what drives everything about hearing. So I will explain to you in a second what that is. But before I do that, let me just tell you what's the significance of the middle chamber. Why is there a special one in there? This one is protected from the outside chambers by a very, very thin membrane, basically to give it a different chemical composition. There's a lot of potassium here, but not, this is salt water, sodium and chloride, but the middle one is full of potassium. Blood tissue pumps a lot of potassium there. It creates effectively a battery. So there is a battery set up between in this region here. And that battery is what drives the electrical currents that convert movements into electrical signals that go into the brain. So if I take one of those things here and enlarge it, that's the picture you see here. So let me, there's the scala, the upper chamber, the lower chamber, and the middle chamber. And the middle chamber is separated from the upper and lower by two membranes, this and this. This is the guy that does all the work, the basilar membrane and the tectorial membrane. And very briefly, this is another picture of the cochlea cut in half. This is the picture I just showed you earlier of the three chambers with the membrane here. And now I'm going to show you a picture which is a little bit bigger and of this structure right here. So very briefly, there are sensors built into here. This sensor is the input sensor that senses vibrations of the sound. And these three are completely different. They're motors. They're very stiff, and they receive input from the brain. There are three of these for each one of these, but 95% of the cables or the fibers or the nerves that leave the ear to the brain come from the hair cells here called the inner hair cells. The outer hair cells are fantastic. They're incredibly sensitive motors that essentially tune your ear to give you fantastic sensitivity. And they're the first to die as you get older. When you hear these whistles in your ears and all that, that's cells dying. But in addition, before they die, they do produce sounds which you normally don't hear, but if you put a microphone in your ear, you will hear them. And they're called autoacoustic emissions. They're affected, they're produced, and modulated by your health, when you run, when you take aspirin, when just like everything biological in your system affects your blood flow and affects the sensitivity of these things that tune your ear to exquisite sensitivity and exquisite tuning. Anyway, let me tell you one last thing. These little tiny cilia on top of each hair cell, and that's the diagram right here, or the picture right here, those guys are really have the gates that allow the potassium to flow into the hair cells. So the way this hair cell works, think of it like a microphone. There's vibrations, which I will explain to you in a second, in the fluids of the vibrations in the fluid of the ear. They apply pressures that cause mechanical vibrations in this structure. This structure basically vibrates up and down. That causes the cilia to move and lets fluids in and out of the microphone. And this microphone then conveys these electrical signals. There is a fantastic engineering discovery that was made about these, which I'll tell you in a minute. But I just want to explain to you first about the functional system function between the input and the output of these hair cells. Now, this is, again, the cochlea. And there's the sound. The sound is complex. It has a lot of different frequencies. Sets up these pressure waves. Now, imagine you have just one frequency in the sound. Let's say 1,000 hertz, 1,000 cycles per second. What happens here is that the fluid is going back and forth at 1,000 per second. So there's, at this place right here, there's fluid going in this direction at 1,000 hertz and in this direction in the opposite phase of 1,000. That sets up a pressure gradient across here, which makes this basilar membrane move up and down. But the way the membrane is structured mechanically, it's almost like the strings on a piano. They're physically have a natural resonance that is different from the high frequency strings, which are thin, and to the, for example, the low frequency strings. Think of the basilar membrane here as composed of beams or strings, and they're driven by that pressure. Now, the beams that have a natural resonance that matches the driving force, they react, they resonate. And when they resonate, they produce large displacements. And that is only happens at the beams that are tuned at one kilohertz. If you change the frequency to 10,000, the beams over here are the ones that have a natural resonance at 10,000, and the ones here have a natural resonance at 100. So when you put a complex sound composed of 100 and 1,000 and 10,000, all of them simultaneously cause vibrations here, here, and here at different places. And that's how the cochlea takes the external sound and breaks it up into basically vibration patterns like this. This is an example of one. So these vibrations. And they are most resonant at one location, which depends on the frequency of the sound. And these are high frequencies. These are low frequencies. This is exactly in the spirit of doing Fourier analysis on the sound. The ear, the cochlea, is doing basically a Fourier transform of the sound, generating a spectrogram. And this shows you here, basically, how the sound comes in. You have, along the length of the cochlea, all these different beams. And these beams, when they vibrate, they generate electrical signals in the hair cells. And the output of each hair cell here is effectively a bandpass filter. So the thing about each one, point here, it basically resonates like a bandpass filter. And this bandpass filter has a certain Q, bandwidth, tuning. And if you think of it as Q of 10, is this familiar terminology? Like the bandwidth, for example, is, so it's like a piano keyboard. So each filter right here is effectively about the same tuning or resolution from at this location as at this location. So if you go here, the filter that is tuned at 1 kilohertz, it has a bandwidth of 100, for example. Whereas the one, it's a logarithmic frequency going about 7, 8, 9 octaves. It's exactly up to about, from about 500 hertz up to about 20 kilohertz, which is the range that you hear. What comes out of each hair cell here is almost exactly the output of a wavelet transform, which corresponds to computing with a bank of bandpass filters that have constant Q on a logarithmic frequency axis. That's what the very first stage of the ear does. That is the reason why your piano is organized like that. It's organized on a logarithmic frequency axis. When you go one octave in frequencies, you go the same distance. It's not because we love to build pianos that look like wavelet transforms. It's because our ear is like that. And much of what we do in hearing and in vision and stuff is based on wavelet transforms because that's the natural transforms that the biological system does. And the reason for that is because you want to have constant resolution over a large dynamic range. If you have the same, if you have not constant resolution, then you have fine resolution in one level and really coarse in the other, you become a prey. So you, that there is a reason why these structures are built this way. I just want to say one last thing about the output of the hair cell, which is, as I said, now a wavelet transform in the first stage at each output. These things, the currents that flow into the hair cell are going at very fast rates. They're going at 1 kilohertz, 2 kilohertz, 10 kilohertz. In a batch, they go in hundreds of kilohertz. How on earth can a cable that goes from the hair cell, made out of fat in salt water, somehow sample these outputs from the wavelet transform and send them up to the brain? So this is, Nyquist is no help here. Because if you want to do Nyquist rate filtering at the output of each of these filters, you need, at this filter right here, you need to sample at minimum of twice the rate or more, which means that you have to send signals at many kilohertz down these cables, down these nerves. And that's impossible. So the way the sampling and the way the system does is, first, it has to digitize. And the reason it has to digitize because you need to send information over long distances. In the whale, 30 meters between the end of the spinal cord all the way up to the fin. And you cannot lose the signal. So you digitize it, you regenerate it all along. But the sampling is a beautiful process. It doesn't sample with a regular clock. Instead, it does what the brain does everywhere, which is sample randomly with a Poisson process at each nerve. So to sample this very fast signal, what the system does, it creates a Poisson process, point process here, with many realizations, many samples simultaneously. And each fiber does not have to sample any faster than 100 hertz, but convey information about 10 kilohertz. And the way it does it is because the Poisson process, here, gives very few points, but the sum of all of these parallel samples get converged to regenerate the signal at the end. This kind of event-like processing is really now very, very interesting for computations, because clocks, you don't need a clock here. You don't need anything regular. You just do it all by what they call event-based processing. Okay, so let me move on to the next stage. This just pictures to show you the tuning. I'm going to skip this. This is a movie to show you the tuning of the... Actually, this is fun. I'll just show you. This is going to play for you what the picture looks like when you play some simple sounds into the ear as it goes into the diaphragm, into the bones, and then in unrolled cochlea. And the sound comes now. Low frequencies at the tip, middle frequencies, high frequencies, and three of them simultaneously. Wavelet transform performed online. Your ear is doing exactly this right now. Okay, this is what the output of the first wavelet transform looks like. So these are mathematical models of these processes. And when you put a single tone, so a single tone here at 300 hertz, for example, generates a wave that doesn't do much in the early part of the cochlea, but at the end of the cochlea, it resonates and it produces this output. One thing is very important about this wavelet transform, its phase is preserved at the first stages. That's why you need that Poisson process to sample and all that. It's not simply you measure the energy coming out of each filter. In fact, the actual waveform is preserved. And there's a lot of information and reasons for that. I'll give you one. This is a cross-section of what you just looked at. If you put two tones in, one at 300, one at 600, you get two outputs from the wavelet transform here, and each has its own time structure or phase in here. And if you look at the energy coming out of each, that's what's shown by the red curve for this one and the black curve for this one, and the sum of these is the green curve. Now, the difference between the dynamic range of a whisper all the way up to a Concorde engine is about 110 dBs. This range is unimaginable, and the way the auditory nerve preserves information about such enormous dynamic range is by, if I take the two tones and I just simply turn the output up higher and higher, the dynamic range saturates at about 30 decibels. 30 decibels, there's no more. It basically, each output becomes a square wave. That's why it's red, blue, red, blue, red, blue. If you look at the green curve that used to show where the two tones were, the output, the energy output, the power output, it looks completely flat now compared to what it used to be, which had nice two peaks. But we perfectly hear fine. How is it possible? And the reason that you can do it is because of that phase of the output of the wavelet transform that is preserved in the auditory nerve. And the reason it does it is the way your eye also does it. If I ask you how many tones are there here, or how many patterns of vibrations, you can see immediately that there is a fast one here and a slow one here. And the reason you can distinguish between these is this mismatch in the rates, or this edge. So all you have to do is edge detection along this axis. You take a derivative, and that extracts basically an edge here and an edge here, and tells you there were two tones, although there is no difference in the energy here or here. Is that clear? And that's what happens when you have a natural speech. If you take the patterns, they're completely on top of each other. But if you take a derivative along this axis, that's the patterns that come out, and this is exactly what's preserved on your in your auditory system up to the brain, and tells you that the spectrum of the sound and all of the information about it. If you do that, you get a spectrogram like this. This conveys everything about the sound. This picture, which doesn't look very impressive, in fact, you can take it and invert this wavelet transform back. Once you extract out what the spectral components are, you don't need any more of the phase. You used it. And then you can throw it away. And your ear does not care about the individual phase of each output of the wavelet transform. It cares about the relative phases, especially within filters that happen to be relatively broad. So anyway, I can invert this back mathematically, and I get the acoustic signal, exactly the original. And you can then think of this as an image. You can translate it down, you can compress it, you can dilate it, and you get very different sounds. I'll just play you that so you get a sense.
We've done our part.
So this is simply inverting it. Here you can invert it after you translate it downwards.
We've done our part.
It becomes like the voice of somebody with a potato in their mouth. You can compress the image and invert it. It becomes...
We've done our part.
Or you can stretch it.
We've done our part.
This is what we do with our mouth when we try to convey certain impressions and stuff like that. And these are what happens to the spectrograms. And if you look in a ferret or a cat ear, you get patterns of activation. These are actual recordings from hundreds of nerve fibers along the length of the cochlea. And you see these phase transitions between one channel and the next. These are the wavelet output at the location of 1 kilohertz with all of the phase preserved. And there's another one right there, and so on. For speech, this is speech, da, all recorded from one animal, the same animal from hundreds of channels. There are 30,000 channels in your ear. So this is 300. Okay, there's a lot of detail as you can imagine, but let me just take you to the next wavelet transform. We are just here, and that's what happened with the so-called, we call, by the way, shorthand spectral analysis here. It's a wavelet transform, but it's mimicking a logarithmic spectrogram. And and it's performed by, we think, in these cochlear nucleus and these different structures. And then is conveyed, this spectrogram is conveyed all the way up to the cortex. When you go up here, and in the intermediate areas, these structures here receive inputs from the two ears, and that gives you the sensation of location in space and so on. Now, when you arrive to the cortex, there's one region right here, it's called the auditory area. Itself is composed of many substructures. The most obvious, the first one that receives the input, it's called the primary area, A1. And I'm going to spend about 10, 15 minutes telling you what you find here when you present sound all the way from the cochlea and you record it, what happens, the activations at this level. But let me just warn you, this area, which is composed of many layers and all that, is the primary area, sends its output to the secondary area, which sends it to the tertiary area, which sends it further all the way up to the frontal areas. All of this brain responds when you hear sound. So it's not really right to say auditory area is just this. That's just where the anatomy or the auditory nerve somehow first arrives to the cortex. But all of these different areas respond. Even your visual areas respond. Because when you watch somebody speaking, you're hearing the sound, but you're watching their lips, and that all of that is integrated. Okay. I'm going to focus on one important property of the sound called timbre, which is sort of the quality of the sound. And as opposed to other things like pitch, location, loudness, and so on. And timbre has to do with why you can tell the difference between a piano and a violin playing the same note at the same loudness from the same location. And if you look at the wavelet transform, or what we call loosely spectrogram, of a violin versus a piano, you can immediately see the differences. One is that the violin is sustained over time, and it has vibrato, whereas the piano is very rapid onset and a rapid decay. You can hear that in the sound. These temporal properties are key for the quality of the sound. And the other important property is the spectral envelope of the sound. So if you take a cross-section here, you see that all these components, spectral components, are the harmonics of the pitch of the sound that you're listening to. But the envelope is the important thing. The envelope of a violin is very complicated because there are a lot of resonances in the box and there are a lot of cancellations and so on. Piano is much simpler envelope. Very smooth. These are very important cues that tell you. Now, the brain needs to extract this. So what I'm going to tell you is, how does the brain extract this information from the first output from the cochlea, which is the first wavelet transform I described for you? Okay, this is the spectrogram of speech. And you're looking at this picture coming out of the cochlea. It has a lot of details, which I will ignore for a minute. But for the time being, just think of the spectrogram as energy coming out of the output of a wavelet transform. So it has two dimensions. Spatial axis, or frequency, logarithmic frequency, and time. And there is the one channel, the energy profile in one. Of course, if you look really carefully and all of that, there's a lot more detail. But just to skip that for a minute, when We record in animals. We work with the ferret because these ferrets are like cats. They live for 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and they live with us all their life. We train them to do all kinds of tasks, and every day they come and they run into the tube. They love to be in tubes, so that's where they feel kind of cozy. I know you feel claustrophobic if you do this. We attach their head so that they don't move their head, and for a couple of hours they listen to sounds and they react by licking water from here or juice or something, and then we record in their brain what they're doing. Now, back to mathematics. If you look at the spectrogram coming out of the cochlea, it's a two-dimensional image. Like any two-dimensional image, I can break it up into a Fourier transform of a two-dimensional sinusoids. And to break it up, I can think of it as the linear weighted sum of two-dimensional sinusoids against the logarithmic frequency axis here and time axis here. So if I take, we call each one of these sinusoids a ripple, okay? And I'm gonna play you one of them so you hear what they sound like. They can change in three ways. They can change their density or their ripple rate or on the frequency axis, and we call that the scale axis. On this, on time, they also change their rate. So this and this are the same temporal rate, 12 cycles per second, 4 cycles per second, whereas these are density. This one has 3, for example, cycles per 5 octaves, and this is the same, but this one has only 1. So you can change the density on this axis, and you can change the direction. The phase of the ripple is the phase going up or down. This is what they sound like. If you go from fast to slow, or if you change the density, these sounds, probably you heard them in electronic games and all that, drive your cortical cells really well. People get hooked on them, they're very annoying also. But out of these, I can make beautiful music. I can make any spectrogram I want. Speech, poetry, all that. I just have to do the Fourier transform on that. So what we do is we go to these cells in the cortex, put one of those wires in, record the electrical activity coming out of that while we play this one or this one or this one or this one. What we're doing is we're treating the entire auditory system like some kind of a filter, and we're putting an input, which is a ripple with a particular frequency and rate and all that, and I can change all of that and I compute the output. That's exactly what you do when you measure whether this box is a low-pass filter or a high-pass filter or a band-pass filter and so on. And this is the example of the kinds of outputs you get from as you change the rate of the ripple, 4 to 32. And over time, you get is the outputs for different rates. And you do this many times for different rates, and you plot the power, for example. So on this axis, I'm changing the rate in time of the ripple, the density of the ripple or the scale, and the direction between left and right. On a one-dimensional filter, you change all the frequencies and you measure the power at each frequency. You measure a transfer function. We can measure the transfer function, except it's two-dimensional Fourier transform. And now each point has actually a phase. You remember, you look at these. These outputs in the cortex are phase locked to the ripple phases. Now, you take the inverse transform, you get an impulse response, a two-dimensional impulse response. And you can do this more efficiently by giving multiple ripples at the same time. And this is what we actually do, is we give the stimuli, we designed all these different types of combinations of ripples. Because of the nonlinearities, you have to be careful that the ripples don't interact and give you false outputs. But the point is, when you do this on, literally, we've done this on thousands of neurons in the brain over the years, you get varieties of these different types of impulse responses. Some look like they're very slow. By the way, red means go up, blue means goes down. So this is, if you look at the cross-section here, it looks like a ringing. A filter responds up and then goes down. And this one looks like it's spread on the frequency axis. This one is very fast compared to this. It's twice as fast. It decays very quickly, where this one rings for a long time. This one looks oriented downwards. You get every imaginable shape and all that. When you look at all of this together, you ask, what is this computationally trying to do? And the most simplest transformation you notice is, in fact, now let me tell you, it's a simple two-dimensional wavelet transform on this image. So you go from here, coming out of the cochlea, you go to the cortex. What you find is that the cortex does a two-dimensional wavelet transform on the output of the cochlea. And that has four different dimensions. It has the dimension of the original frequency axis. That's here. Then it has, you remember, the density or the scale, and also the rate, and the rate has direction, phase, up or down. And all of this is a function of time. So it's just the representation of timbre, or the spectral shape, already gives you four dimensions at the level of the cortex. It's a wavelet transform on the output of the cochlea, but the cochlea was a wavelet transform to start with. So this is a double wavelet transform. One-dimensional and then two-dimensional. And now you've produced, there's really very little. I can look at this and tell you about the acoustic waveform. Except that you must do that. So, sequence of two wavelet transformations from sound to spectrogram, spectrogram to the cortical representation. And this cortical representation, for the same reason that the cochlea did a wavelet transform, you remember I told you, it's very important to keep multi-resolution and multi-scale, multi-resolution, and so on and so forth for perceptual reasons. The same exact reason applies to the way the cortex represents the spectrogram. It's in images and in sound, speech processing, before, about 5 years ago, everybody in speech analysis did a double Fourier transform. And you ask, why did they do a double Fourier transform? Actually, they did a double wavelet transform, but they implemented it as a double Fourier transform. And they used to call it the Kepstrom for complicated reasons. But the point of it is that the reason people found it is because it worked. They had no idea why. They should pick this versus a million other ways. But when they used that, every time they got a mistake or an error here, it corresponded to an error in the perception. So they say, this is a good representation of speech. We'll use that. In images, people use pyramidal algorithms to elaborate the image. And thus we're also effectively a wavelet transform on the XY dimensions of the images. And Stefan, scattering in physics is a multi-resolution representation. And you can write a mathematical representation of everything I just told you in terms of impulse responses with different directions and all that. Basically, these are mother wavelets that literally are that have a frequency function and a time function, and you take their products and you generate a spectrotemporal receptive field. It's a two-dimensional mother wavelet that then you can dilate in all different directions to give you a full, glorious two-dimensional wavelet transform that can represent tones and spectrograms and so on and so forth. And is an example of doing that exact wavelet transform, but without the time axis, just on the scale axis, on the spectrum of a vowel. So if you look at the original spectrum of the vowel, and that's the output of a wavelet transform on the cochlea wavelet transform, that's the power. Now, if you do on this another wavelet transform, you get on this axis is the scale axis, and basically gives you multi-resolution representation. So if you look at this cross-section, which is this black curve here, it shows you the broad envelope of the sound. If you want to have a finer representation of this scale, of this axis, of this pattern, you go to the fine scales, and that gives you every detail you want. And in fact, this whole representation you can efficiently capture, code it by the bifurcation points of these different branches. And there's a lot you can do with these kinds of representations. Let me end this by showing you some examples in the brain of a ferret of this two-dimensional wavelet transform on complex sounds like speech and music, okay? So what we do is we present a full sentence or piece of music, and that's what the spectrogram looks like at the output of the cochlea. Then we record what this looks like in one cell, and then another, and then another, and another. We collect 100 cells in one animal, and then we constitute the two-dimensional or four-dimensional picture of what the wavelet transform is doing. So the way we do that is we have to first ask, what is the cell? You remember that cube I just showed you of the cortex. One cell is one point in that cube. So in order to show you a picture of that cube, I need to go and find where does that one neuron fit in that cube. So I have to find where does it fall on the frequency axis, where does it fall on the scale axis, where does it fall on the rate, direction, and so on and so forth. So that's what we do. We go and find its frequency sensitivity, and then we do a two-dimensional, we do a Fourier transform to find where the so that's the best frequency and the best rate, that's the Fourier transform, and the best scale. So each neuron is captured by three indices and over time its response. So these are example of five neurons, just five out of 5 million. You see, they're capturing very different properties. These guys are very broadly tuned. These are very narrow. This is high frequency. This is intermediate. This is low frequency, and so on and so forth. These are the cochlear outputs of three sounds, aw, sh, and m. Okay? So we want to know, how does this aw appear on 100 of these guys? Don't give up. This is from a ferret brain. And just some series of vowels. Okay? There's a reason they're organized that way, you can tell. And these are their outputs from the cochlea, or what we call the input to the cortex. And each panel here is composed of the output of 100 neurons, roughly. And they're organized on that cube along their frequency axis, or their scale, or their rates. We call these sometimes bandwidth and speed. And now, I can collapse that cube on the frequency axis, and that's the representation of the spectrum in the cortex at the output of that wavelet transform for this spectrum. And that is the representation if you collapse on the scale axis, and this is the representation if you collapse on the rate axis. If you plot all three simultaneously, you get a beautiful representation of these phonemes in the three axes of frequency, rate, and scale. Those are stationary sounds. You can hold it. There's no time axis. So you could see there is a beautiful organization of these vowels in the cortex, cortex of a ferret, which represents the nature of these vowels. We perceive are very different from E because their R is open vowels, closed vowels. People for a long time studied the phonetics, and they organized phonemes based on the way we produce them, based on the way we perceive them and all that. But this gives you the biological reason based on the wavelet transform of why we should represent them like this. These are consonants. Dynamic sounds, pa, ta, ka, sh, and so on. And this is the way the ferret perceives these. Let me just tell you that if you present to a human these sounds, ba, da, ga, va, the, z, m, n, for example, and you put it in noise, people have the same confusion matrix as the ferret. So perception of phonemes for humans and ferrets are not that different. And that justifies why we can do these experiments. Okay, what else can you do with this wavelet transform? What use has it been actually found to do? I'll give you some feel for what we can do with them. You can look at the sound, the spectrogram, or the wavelet transform from the cochlea, and you can study its temporal structure in fine detail at different resolutions. These pictures give you what happens at 10 hertz, at 4 hertz, and at 2 hertz. Why am I showing you this? When you go to a doctor and they put these caps on your head to do your EEG analysis, and they talk, in fact, what they record and when they analyze is exactly pictures that look like this. They call them the alpha band and the theta band and gamma band and all the Greek soup, Greek letters. And all these different bands, they're basically wavelet transforms on the spectrogram with different resolutions. That's all. Literally, you can predict all of that. So it's a nice way to give you a quantitative way of understanding what is going on. And it gives you also a feel for what can go wrong at different, as I'll explain to you in a minute. You can do the same thing on the picture here, but do it on the scale axis. And so you can break up the sound into different resolutions and so on and so forth. Let me just skip this. I'll show you some other things. For example, what do these sounds appear to you like when you change these resolutions? A ferret and a cats and dogs. You talk to your dog or your cat all the time. You really think a dog hears you the same way as your husband or wife hears you? They don't. And it's okay. They can understand you, you hope. But this is what they sound like. This is the original sound.
We've done our part.
This is what your dog hears it as.
We've done our part.
Not as pretty. And that's because dogs don't have, their wavelet transforms don't have the resolution that we do. We have a better resolution. And so they lose the melody and the pitch of the sound. And they hear it more like whispered almost or something. What about if you're sleepy and your fast brain cells that code the high rates in your speech are now not working well? That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
This is exactly what you hear when you go in an echoic environment and you smear the sounds. You reduce the rates, the higher rates, the sound feels smeared, and it's very affected intelligibility. And this is the opposite. If you keep only the high rates, like you...
We've done our part.
You emphasize the onsets and all the syllables. And when the brain has a representation of all these rates, all these scales, in the cortex, each cell is giving you all these representations of the double wavelet transform. It can use it by basically picking up this part and this part and putting it together and gives you a completely different picture of what the sound is like. You do this also with images. When you look at a painting, you can look at it very close and you see the brushstroke, or you can look from far and you get the overall profile. This is literally, you are basically filtering different components of your wavelet transform. That's literally what you're doing. And this is here, the sound with the cochlear output was taken, put it in this two-dimensional wavelet transform, take the high rates from one and the low scales from the other and merge them. That's it. Now, I forgot to mention something very important. It's really not feasible to do any of this work if you're unable to go back from the output of this these double wavelet transforms all the way back to the acoustic waveform so I can play it to you. And so that is possible. And everything, as I showed you, was actually going all the way into that double wavelet transform, manipulate it, filter it, do stuff with it in that domain, and then invert all the way back and play it out. Okay? So this is what happens if you just take one scale and some rates from a natural voice.
We've done our part.
And this is a natural sound from an oboe. As trivial as that.
We've done our part.
And invert it, you get immediately the voice singing. And you can do all kinds of stuff like that only because you've done all the work. You've analyzed all the sound. You have all the different components. What else? People do architectural acoustics all the time. When they build a hall like this and spend on the Philharmonia €1 billion, they better get the sound right. And the way they know that, whether they got the sound right or not, for a long time people have been doing exactly what I've just been showing you, which is, you take the sound, you generate basically the wavelet transforms of all of that, and then you look at what clean speech looks like from a recording and what a microphone in this room looks like. So this is what the transfer function of a healthy brain, when I use the word transfer function, I mean the double wavelet transform of a clean sound or tested, yeah? That's what it looks like. If you add white noise, that's what it looks like compared to this. If you add reverberation, that's what it looks like compared to this. If you add noise and reverberation, it's a mess. If you just measure this distance, it predicts very nicely how intelligible the speech is and how pleasant perhaps the music is and so on, okay? So it's very important tool. This is actually even more sophisticated than what is used even nowadays to measure the acoustics in a room. But it's in the same spirit. You could do the same thing. For example, if you want to do pattern classification on instruments or on voices, on anything, on images, you take the cochlear outputs, which is that first wavelet transform, you do a second one, you have a full representation of the violin. Those are the coefficients on the scale and rate axes of a violin, piano, clarinet, oboe. These are very nice. You can now stick it in a neural network and train it and do your classification based on patterns that are already quite distinguished with this kind of representation. If you use a time waveform, it's not the same. And if you train a 150-layer neural network to do that kind of classification, people have found that, in fact, the early layers essentially recreate the wavelet transforms. So they're doing what you already know that the ear does, for example, because that's what the supervised training is doing. And you can I have one more slide after this. This slide, just to tell you that you can do filtering fully in the wavelet domain now. So you can take the sound, take it all the way up to this cortical representation, filter it, because speech lives in a particular subset of coefficients, noise lives in another one, and music in yet another, and you can segregate them based on that, and then invert all the way back. So you can suppress the noise and all that, and invert, you get nice, clean speech and all that. Let me finish with one last slide. You can do the same thing, and this is now used a lot, on the actual neural outputs from the brain of humans and animals and ferrets. So we can record the output of each pixel, so to speak, in that 3D representation of the cortical activity, and we can take 100 of these, and just like I showed you, exactly, we can invert the wavelet transform all the way back to the acoustics, and now hear what the animal, actually, electrical activity in the animal is, sounds like. So this is an example of reconstructing from about 90 neurons.
Bridges, tunnels, and ferries are the most...
sound. Let me play it, sorry. And this is the reconstruction.
Bridges, tunnels, and ferries are the most common methods of...
So there's only 92 neurons. You have millions of neurons. So presumably you can now, you can, by the way, do this on humans. You can do these recordings in humans during surgeries and all that. And you can invert the sound and actually hear what the how much of the electrical activity has survived in order to convey perception to people. You can do a lot more, but you got the idea. That's that why these representations are useful in the biology. You're welcome.